Back together again, you and I chatting it up Thursday style, July 17th, 2025 on Connecticut Today. We opened the show today wondering whether state officials could stand in the way of the feds if the federal government pursues the deportation of an 18-year-old illegal alien who almost killed two state police troopers a few days ago. Republican State Senate member Rob Sampson also weighed in on that same case. Bridgeport Charter Revision Commission Chair Faith Sweeney and Vice Chair John Hosier talked about proposals for strengthening ethics safeguards and regulations in the city. CBS News reporter Olivia Rinaldi joined us from D.C. with the latest on the Jeffrey Epstein controversy. University of New Haven Associate Professor of Homeland Security and National Security and International Affairs Dr. Matthew Schmidt drop by again to look at the current situation regarding Ukraine, Russia, and the U.S., and National Taxpayers Union Interstate Commerce Initiative Director and Senior Policy Analyst Andrew Wilford explain how Connecticut's current tax code treats non-resident workers.
And it's already begun, and I told you the other day when this story popped up, I said, here it comes. And we're talking about this story where an illegal alien in Enfield, he's not a minor, he's 18 years old. I know they're saying, oh, he's a high school student, he doesn't have a record. I don't care. He needs to be booted. ICE needs to come in and boot this guy the hell out of the country. But that probably is not what Connecticut officials want here. Because remember, the Trust Act, as it's written right now, technically does not allow the state police or local Enfield police or anybody who responded to the scene of that accident a few days ago, which almost killed a couple of state troopers. We have that asinine Trust Act that doesn't allow anybody to hand over somebody who's suspected of being illegal in this state to ICE, because we're idiots. The teen is facing driving violation charges in connection with a crash that sent two state police troopers to a hospital. Homeland Security has confirmed that federal agents are looking to arrest the teen accused of hitting two state troopers with a car that spun out on I-91 in Enfield last week. A senior DHS official telling Fox 61 on Wednesday that Joel Kaiser of Waterbury is not a U.S. citizen and he is from Ecuador. ICE has lodged a detainer for his arrest. That's according to a DHS statement. Kaiser entered the U.S. in 2023, and his attorney is already trying to say, well, he just made a mistake. It was a car accident. No, no, no. He hydroplaned, doing an estimated 85 miles an hour, injuring a trooper, seriously injuring somebody else. He's not a little kid who needs mommy. He's 18. And he's an illegal. He shouldn't be here, and he's from Guatemala. He attended a virtual arraignment on Wednesday afternoon. Yesterday, bond was set at $20,000. He was ordered not to operate motor vehicles while the case is pending. The next court date regarding this case is August the 8th. Now, you watch. I'm telling you, folks, in the next couple, 3 weeks, this guy is going to become the next Kilmar Abrego Garcia. This guy is going to become a celebrity. Oh, he only made a mistake. No, no, no. Driving in a rain where you're hydroplaning at allegedly 85 miles an hour, that's not a mistake. That's being a moron. I don't care what language you say it in. I don't know how you say that in Guatemala, what the word in Guatemala is for a moron. But this guy is. And his public defender is already saying, well, he's a high school student in Waterbury. He doesn't have any record. I don't care. He needs to go. And hopefully DHS will boot him the hell out of this state. Troopers Matthew Sari and Christopher Genovese were responding to a previous crash and were on the right shoulder when Kaiser's car hit a pool of standing water and lost control. Well, he lost control, the troopers say, because he was doing 85 miles an hour. And this guy probably knows he's an illegal. He ain't that smart. Really? I'm in the country illegally. What kind of moron is in the country illegally and does 85 miles an hour? Can somebody explain that to me? The vehicle spun out, colliding with a state police vehicle that was on the shoulder. That police vehicle then struck another police vehicle, and a trooper was standing by nearby. The injuries to Genovese were considered serious. Sari had only minor injuries. Three other people involved in both the initial crash and the subsequent crash also suffered minor injuries. The officers are expected to be okay. Now, thank God. Thank God. But here's the problem. We have this Trust Act, which, again, the Democratic majority in the legislature, the crazy ones, toughened up even more. And what it does is, under Connecticut law, it puts every sort of speed bump, block, wall in front of local law enforcement and state police, cooperating with ICE, cooperating with DHS. And I've talked about this in other cases. I get these news releases from DHS. We had a couple of those and ICE a couple of months ago about, you know, convicted sex offenders just being let out of jail. And some of the morons that run this state, they won't hold these people when ICE calls and says, listen, this is a bad guy. We got to get this guy out of here. But no, because they're here for the American dream. So you watch. Folks, I'm telling you, you watch. Keep an eye out on this one, because this guy is going to become a cause célèbre. I'm telling you. You watch. As the coverage of this case ramps up even more than it is, and kudos to some of the broadcast outlets in this state who actually say he's an undocumented migrant or an illegal, and some that don't. I'm not going to mention names here, but I'm reading some of these news stories going, what, really? You're leaving out key facts here? Oh, because somebody told you to. But I digress. So apparently, this guy's got another hearing coming up in August, and he's not a citizen. He's an illegal who's been here about 2 years. And he's in high school in Waterbury. Okay, fine. I don't care. He's got to go. If he's found guilty of the charges, obviously. But you watch. They are already trying to frame it. And they, meaning the usual suspects, people in the media, and I'm sure they're going to have the migrants' rights groups are going to start coming out now and saying, well, he just made a mistake. It was raining. They'll blame it on the weather. Almost killing two state police troopers when you're an illegal from Guatemala who shouldn't be here driving 85 miles an hour in tricky weather. Oh, but, you know, he didn't mean anything. And they saw him, and, you know, and they did the virtual video hookup for his court appearance. He looks like he's crying and sobbing. Hey, too bad, pal. Bye-bye. See you later. But here's what you have to watch. And I'll tell you what you have to watch coming up. Because at least half of the General Assembly in Hartford, they will try and fight this. They will try to put up every roadblock they can to prevent DHS and ICE. Now, remember, this guy didn't. We're not talking about swiping a box of candy bars here. We're not talking about, you know, stealing a couple of gallons of gasoline. We're talking about a situation that a couple of inches either way, a couple of miles an hour either way, you could have had two dead state police troopers, or at least one dead trooper and one critically injured trooper. But again, you watch, and again, some of the stuff behind this case is, I'm telling you, it's already falling into place. Oh, leave him alone. He's traumatized.
Yeah,
I am telling you, this 18-year-old guy who almost killed a couple of state police troopers in Enfield the other day, who is an illegal, undocumented, unaccounted for, unreliable, whatever euphemism you want to use, he is going to become a cause célèbre for the far left in this state. He had a virtual court appearance yesterday. They tell me somebody sent me some information saying he's next due in court on the 6th of August. And we'll see what happens. He faced a judge virtually. Joel Kaiza appeared virtually, facing charges of reckless driving, driving too fast, failure to maintain an established lane, and operating a car without a license. Now, DHS, Homeland Security, says we're coming after this guy. They've already said it, according to what I'm reading here. They saw what happened. Somebody probably got a hold of him. Maybe in the state police. You can't do that technically under Connecticut law. I don't know. So watch what I'm telling you. You watch what happens here. Because as the Republican caucus points out here in the state, and I've mentioned this before to you folks, and a lot of you folks are amazed when I tell you this. Do you know that even in a situation like this, where some kid almost kills a couple of state troopers driving 85 miles an hour, allegedly in some pretty bad weather the other night, because he's an illegal, the state of Connecticut cannot call DHS in here and say, get rid of him. Now, the dummies in Hartford will tell you, well, it's because, you know, border security is a federal purvey and not a local purvey. Okay, now these are the same people that try and ride different gun laws. A lot of them are found unconstitutional. So they like the federal government when they like the feds. They hate the feds when the feds guarantee the Second Amendment. So a lot of the people in Hartford are feckless too. So several members of the Connecticut Republican Senate caucus quite properly sent out a news release the other day saying, quote, remember that Connecticut is a super sanctuary state. A law passed by Democrats prohibits local and state law enforcement from working with the feds for violent crimes on certain immigration issues, even terrorism. So I'm telling you, you watch this, folks. You watch this. I am telling you, this kid, do I feel bad for him? Yeah, sort of, but not really. The Republican caucus said, quote, now we learn the person who nearly killed our state troopers is here illegally, but under state law, Connecticut authorities are prohibited from turning him over to immigration despite his arrest. You hear that, folks? Connecticut authorities, this is a kid who almost kills two state troopers, who is here illegally, who should now get the hell out. And he's not a kid, he's a man, he's 18. Oh, what of his family here? I don't care. You drove 85 miles an hour in horrendous rain. If you had any business, any brains, you would have slowed down to maybe 50 or 55 and turned on your flashers, gotten past the scene of this accident and drove with two hands on the wheel. On top of that, taxpayers are forced to spend hundreds of millions of dollars subsidizing people in the U.S. and Connecticut who are here illegally. But again, not only is the Trust Act still here, which prohibits any local cooperation from law enforcement to the feds, Democrats in Hartford made it even more difficult for law enforcement to cooperate. So do you understand something here? If the federal government, not just under President Trump, but anybody, if even under the Biden years, if they were to call and say, hey, can you hold this guy for us? Because once his criminal case is done, we want to boot this guy. Do you know Connecticut law doesn't allow our fine men and women in law enforcement, local law enforcement, and state troopers doing that? Why is that? So Connecticut lawmakers, primarily on the Democratic side, they value the lives and liberty of immigrants, illegals, more than they do the residents and citizens of this state that are duly deputized to protect us on the state police level and on the local police level. If you don't believe me, look up the Trust Act. And I kind of thought this was a possibility. I didn't get too much into it over the past couple of days. But now, technically now, maybe if Governor Ned Lamont is smart, maybe if he gets a little wink and nod from the state police or the Enfield cops, maybe he says, hey, call ICE on this guy. But there is a chance, and I'm crossing my fingers here, there is a chance that even with the violence of this accident, to which, thank God, one state trooper wasn't injured too badly, the other has some pretty significant injuries, they say he's eventually going to recover. But even with that, and even with the fact that the alleged driver here is an illegal from Guatemala who shouldn't be here, he might get to stay. What do you think of that? And I know all his family, they just came. I don't care. It's a question of common sense. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Should Connecticut law allow more cooperation between local law enforcement and federal officials when it comes to criminal cases? Because right now there is a fear here that's palpable that this 18-year-old who made decisions to do what he did, he wasn't 11 or 12, he was 18, allegedly doing 85 miles an hour in the rain, but the fact that he's an illegal, that may not matter. Hey, stay here for the American dream. Come on. Come on. But again, we're insulted this way by the Democratic majority in Hartford every couple of years. And shame on you people for voting for them again and again and again. Joining us right now, Republican State Senate member Rob Sampson, one of the Republican caucus members who are pointing out that Connecticut has this Trust Act, and we talked about this early on, that may stand in the way, hopefully not, but it may stand in the way of Homeland Security and ICE getting rid of an illegal alien here in the state who almost killed, thankfully didn't, but almost killed a couple of state police troopers the other night in Enfield. Rob Sampson, how are you, sir? How you been?
I am well, Paul, and thanks for covering this story. Boy, this one really, really gets to you.
Yeah, and I guess to their credit, The Current and a couple of other outlets are asking the governor, asking Bob Duff, asking Marty Looney, hey, what do you people have to say on this? Now, Rob, break this down. I did this earlier in the show. Break this down for my listeners here. You have this 18-year-old illegal who, thank God, didn't kill a couple of state troopers. One was hurt more than the other, but they're all going to be okay. But now the story may take a twist because of what's called the Trust Act. So explain that for my listeners. Frankly, many of whom, Rob, when I explained this earlier in the show, they couldn't believe what I was telling them.
Right. Well, first and foremost, our thoughts and prayers go out to the two officers involved, and we certainly hope that they are going to be okay. The Trust Act is a policy put into effect in Connecticut back in 2013, but the bigger issue is that it was expanded dramatically in 2019 by Connecticut Democrats. Over my objections in the Senate, I debated this bill for many, many hours, and basically what it does is it allows people that are in the country illegally, even if they have criminal backgrounds, even if they are wanted by police, even if they are suspected of terrorism or on the no-fly list or known gang members, things like that, they are actually protected by Connecticut law from federal immigration officials. It is one of the most unbelievable policies we have in the state of Connecticut. It's something that I have been harping on for many, many years, beginning in 2019 when I coined the term super sanctuary state to describe just how bad our policy is compared to even other crazy places like California.
Now, DHS, Rob, according to the versions of this that I have read, and you've probably seen a couple of the TV stations anyway, are reporting that DHS, I guess they say they've already contacted state officials here, you know, about maybe if this is true, maybe deporting this 18-year-old. Now, has the state said anything back? And would they, do you think, as they have in other cases here, this wouldn't be a first-time case, would they stand in the way of this, Rob, do you think, or not?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we have a history going back since the dawn of the Trust Act in the state of Connecticut of basically blocking any local or state law enforcement officials from communicating with federal immigration authorities to aid in the deportation of a illegal alien, criminal or otherwise. And what I wanted to say about that is that just this past year, the Democrats actually doubled down on this policy and they expanded it. So it's not even just law enforcement officials. It's any state employee. And I think it actually includes municipal employees, too. All forbidden. You cannot cooperate with federal immigration authorities. Basically, what they're doing is they're saying we are going to ignore federal immigration law. We are going to stand in the way of the Trump administration and their desire to restore sense at our borders.
This young man, this 18-year-old, state police say he was driving his 2010 Acura TXS north when he hit a puddle of water in the left lane, lost control of the vehicle, 91 North on July 10th around 7:30. The Acura spun out of control across multiple lanes toward the scene of a multi-vehicle crash that had occurred near exit 47 WA up in the north part of
Enfield there. So along with allegedly, Rob, being in the country illegally here, you've got somebody who was speeding. Now, his attorney, I guess, said, well, he was only doing about 65. The cops say he was doing more, but that's immaterial. And, Rob, I hope this doesn't happen, but I wonder if they're going to try and make a celebrity out of this kid. You already heard from, I guess, his public defender or a lawyer saying the arraignment, well, he doesn't have a criminal record. Well, so what? I mean, that's not the issue here, is it?
Right, and he was also obviously driving without a license, despite the fact that the Connecticut Democrats have gone so far as to offer driver's licenses to people that are in the country unlawfully. I mean, this is what this is really all about. This is just yet another incident that occurred in our state where we have state of police officers that are in danger of their lives because of policies put on the books on party lines by Connecticut Democrats with zero respect for the rule of law. I mean, what kind of message is this to send to people that are leaving their own countries, that you can come here, you can drive without a license, you can speed on our highways. There's no repercussions for anything. And your listeners, I'm sure, you know, they drive on the highway just like you and I do, and I'm sure they're watching, lawlessness on a day-to-day basis. That's what's happening in our society, and a lot of it is based on policies being put in place at the government level that are basically weakening our laws, weakening the rule of law across the board, and encouraging bad acts and bad behavior, including inviting illegal aliens to come here and commit their crimes.
Amazing. Rob Sampson. Rob, thank you. Keep up the heat with the people in the caucus there. We'll be in touch. Thank you, sir.
You bet. Thanks so much.
All right. There you go. Rob Sampson there, Republican state Senate member. So we will see. We will see as this case moves along, I guess, the next court date for this young man who's, and they're calling him a teen. Come on, you folks in the media. He's 18. He's an adult. One of the things I've been talking about on this program, because I'm very passionate about it, is government making itself better. And maybe recognizing, hey, what we allowed in the past, we should not allow anymore. Well, Bridgeport is trying to do that, as many cities and towns are. And every so often, your city or town may have done it. It's called charter revision. Sometimes you got to update the owner's manual, right? It's going on to the city of Bridgeport right now. And we have the chair and the vice chair of the city of Bridgeport Charter Revision Commission on. Faith Sweeney is the chair, and John Hosier is the vice chair, and I believe we have them both right now. Faith and John, good afternoon. It's Paul. How are you?
Thank you, Mr. Priscelli. Good afternoon.
Hey, good to have you with us. All right, Faith, let's start out with you. I guess we have a scenario here now where we are looking at trying to boost or stiffen up or maybe revamp ethics in the city of Bridgeport. Now, I don't care whether it's Bridgeport or anywhere else. I like ethics. Ethics to me are good. I was always taught that way by mom and dad. So what are you trying to achieve here? And I understand there's a meeting coming up on this. So Faith, tell us about that.
Yes. Part of our charter revision updates is creating an Office of Municipal Ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a ethics commission already, and they are doing what their best. And we want to give more teeth to ethics issues in this city.
Mm-hmm. John, your thoughts on that, and adding to what Faith just said. What are your feelings on the process here that is underway now?
Well, our hope is that they will fund the Office of Municipal Ethics. It's going to be the first and only one ever in the state of Connecticut.
Mm.
Our thrust is that Bridgeport has always had a black eye. As a matter of fact, we had some things come out today.
Really?
That put no trust in the city of Bridgeport. And this will be the strongest ethics in the state of Connecticut that we're putting forward. It goes from one paragraph that we have in our charter right now to over four pages.
Mm-hmm.
So go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, so John, let me ask the operative question here, because a lot of people are listening saying,
Well, who could be against this? And I know there are always some people against something in any city and town, no matter how good it sounds. So are you having a real fight on this? And if so, what's the problem? Break that down for me.
Well, the fight, I believe, is going to be in funding the office itself having a director. The issue is going to be we don't have the money. But they found the money for a lot of different other things. And what we've lost in regards to our unethical practices is a hell of a lot more than we would, you know, that are just giving us a couple hundred thousand or whatever we need to make this happen. They're going to say we don't have the money. And well, guess what? We don't have the time to waste anymore.
Yeah, Faith, let me ask you, Faith. I mean, this whole thing about not having the money, does that kind of ring hollow, maybe, as John said here? Is that a kind of thing as, oh, sure, it's money, wink, wink? What are your thoughts on that?
I think that if this is a priority, they will find the money. We can't afford to not have an Office of Municipal Ethics. Mm-hmm. As John just shared with you, something happened today related to ethical violations. And ethical violations in our city have increased over time. And we need to really go back to thinking about what is ethical behavior as an employee or a public official. And is there training? Are they trained every year on a yearly basis? Are they acknowledging what the code of ethics is every year? And so we want to bring this back so that people are very clear on what is ethical and what is not ethical in government and in service.
And Faith, you and John had just mentioned a bit about something else that popped up today. Is that privileged information, or can you just tell me what you were alluding to there about another ethical problem here?
It was in a newspaper today about an officer getting fired.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then there was also something in the paper today, I believe it was today, regarding the absentee ballot issues that have happened over the last few years.
Yeah.
So that brings it to me. And if anybody's afraid or not willing to support this ethics, then I'm guessing that they want to be unethical.
Well, no, and guys, you know, Faith, you laugh, and John, but I understand that. I mean, who could, again, you know, it's the question, who could be against this? And don't give me the and I'm not saying you guys, but I'm saying rhetorically, don't give me the money aspect of it here. Now, who would lead this office that you'd like to do? How many people would be there? What kind of training would this encounter?
That's to be seen, but it would So a professional that's steeped in ethics, mm-hmm. could be a lawyer, retired lawyer. To keep it apolitical, the individual would be appointed by the Ethics Commission.
Okay.
Another thing that we're hoping for, and it's a reach, but the attorney for the Ethics Commission to be separate from the City of Bridgeport.
Mm.
Right now we have in there. That the Ethics Commission can ask for an attorney if it deems necessary. But it would be nice to have one completely absent from the administration.
Now, Faith, I understand that there is a meeting coming up, this coming Monday night. Can people go and voice their opinions on this at this meeting?
Yes, they definitely can. It's the City Council is holding a public hearing at 6 p.m. at Lyons Terrace, mm-hmm. where any resident can come out, listen to what other people are talking about, and also hear what City Council is going to consider for this charter revision.
Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, Paul, there's their first meeting regarding the commission. And it changes. It's tonight at 6 o'clock at City Hall. It's with the council members.
Oh, okay. All right. Excellent. Well, listen. what's your gut feeling? Let me ask both of you here. If you had a look into your crystal ball, Faith, I'll start with you. Is this commission going to happen or not? What do you think?
The office. The commission is already in place.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry. The office. I'm sorry. Yeah.
actually, at one of our meetings, many of the city council members did support having an office.
Mm-hmm.
So I am hopeful that we can get this established. And the funding piece is really important. We do need to have the funding, and that's where I'm a little bit unsure. And I am just hoping that they will make this a priority, because Bridgeport needs to remove the black eye.
John, what do you think? What's your gut feeling, John, as we wrap up here?
This is going to happen because we're not going to let it not happen, the bottom line.
All right. Looking for a Bridgeport Office of Ethics and a strengthened Ethics Commission with teeth. So boost the commission and establish a new office. Great stuff here. We've been talking to Bridgeport Charter Revision Commission Chair Faith Sweeney and the Vice Chair John Hosier. Faith, John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And good luck. Thanks, folks. Appreciate it. Let's take you to D.C. now, as we like to do at least a few times a week, with our friend, CBS News correspondent. You see her on the evening news. You hear her on WICC here. Olivia Rinaldi. Olivia, good afternoon. How are you? Never a dull day there where you are, huh?
Hi, Paul. Yeah, never a dull day. It's certainly very interesting the last couple of days, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, so before we get to this notion on the president's health here, which is kind of surprising, boy, this Jeffrey Epstein thing, Olivia, it's just not going away. Now members of Congress want to do something. Mr. Trump doesn't. So what's the latest on that?
Oh, yeah, they can't shake this Epstein story, which is one that they kind of ginned up, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the president yesterday had put out that Truth Social post calling people, even his supporters who are still listening to the conspiracies around Epstein, weaklings. It was really the first time we've seen him rebuke even his own base, specifically on this issue. Caroline Leavitt also briefed the press today, where she was asked to clarify which part of the Epstein hoax is a hoax.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that the president was referring to the fact that Democrats have now, quote, seized on this as if they've ever wanted transparency when it comes to Epstein. But the important part of this is that there are several Senate Republicans who are asking the Trump administration to release more information about the Jeffrey Epstein case. And they really brushed off Trump's assertion that Democrats or Republicans are weak, rather, for falling for this hoax. You know, even Josh Hawley said that people were calling for further information. Eric Schmidt, Tom Tillis, Lindsey Graham, all Republican senators who are saying, well, wait a minute. If we have the files, we should release them, or at least release more information. So that's kind of what we're tracking on that. I'll tell you, just as a personal anecdote, yesterday I was with the vice president out in Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
He's talking about the economy. He's talking about the big, beautiful bill. So I started asking supporters who were there, you know, it's great on the economy. What about Jeffrey Epstein? They were upset.
Really?
So upset. Oh, my gosh. A lot of them said they voted for Trump, and this is the one thing about this administration that is really bothering them.
Wow. No wonder there's been such a reaction from Congress. And finally, Olivia, before we let you go, kind of a revelation about Mr. Mm-hmm. Trump's health, and I guess kind of a reminder here. He may look good, he may have vitality, but he is an older gentleman. So we heard about a circulation issue, is it today?
Yeah, so what they're saying is this is a chronic venous insufficiency. It's actually fairly common.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially what it is it's a lack of blood flow throughout the body, but most often presented in the legs by swelling.
Yeah.
And there were questions about this because we had seen, you know, President Trump, when he was sitting down, you can kind of see around his socks, there was a little bit of like swelling by his feet.
Yeah.
And then on his hands, he often had bruising that was covered up by concealer. And, you know, I noticed it because obviously I wear makeup, and I was like, that concealer is not his color. What is that concealer from? And so Caroline Leavitt said today, she read out a note from the president's physician announcing this venous insufficiency. It's fairly common.
Yeah.
It's something that a lot of people in their older years have, and it basically is just amounting to an issue of blood flow, but it's not a serious condition.
Well, Olivia, before I let you go, seeing as you're being honest with me, I'll be honest with you. Yes, I wear some concealer, too, when I do when I do college hockey games in the winter on TV. So, yes, I admit it, too. You have to.
It's long days. Right, exactly. You know, you get tired. You got to put a little concealer on.
That's right. But, those bags,
you know,
under my eyes.
You know your color match.
Yes, I do. Absolutely. Olivia Rinaldi, CBS News. Olivia, thanks. Have a happy weekend. We appreciate it.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks. Bye-bye. How about that? Great stuff there from Olivia Rinaldi, CBS News. Yeah, you see her on TV, CBS Evening News, on and off almost every night during the week. And you hear her here on WICC and our top and bottom of the hour network news. All right, still at the forefront with everything else going on, and that really connects here with a lot of people in Connecticut, the ongoing war between Russia and Ukraine and the role the U.S. is trying to play there, correctly or otherwise. And one of our go-to people on that, we welcome back Dr. Matthew Schmidt, University of New Haven, Associate Professor of Homeland, National Security, and International Affairs. Matt, it's Paul here. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us again. We appreciate it. How are you?
I'm all right. Hi, Paul. It's great to talk to you again.
Well, thank you, sir. Well, Matt, it's been a while, and I guess we're having somewhat of a 180 from the White House. I don't know. It's all tough to figure out what's going on here. Third-party supplies of weapons now. So what is the latest here, and what do you make of the latest round of threats and deal-making here between all three, and is there any end in sight of this or not? Are we just kidding ourselves?
Well, I'll start at the end. No, there's no end in sight right now, okay. So we need to be prepared for it to continue.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on? I think Trump really wants that Nobel Peace Prize. he really wants to end the war, whether for altruistic reasons or selfish reasons, doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
And so he decided that he wasn't getting much traction pushing Zelensky, and he was going to push Putin instead. And Putin's response was no response. He actually hasn't publicly said anything. excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
Dmitry Medvedev, the former president, has threatened to start World War III and said the West should stay out of things and et cetera, et cetera. But basically the Russians went, this is a theatrical ultimatum and we don't care. And they're continuing to push their offensive in the east.
Matt, I you know, in the past few months, trying to soak all this in, or really the past few years since this whole thing started, you and I have been talking about this more than a few times here, and I'm hearing more and more people on both sides saying, hey, if there's a chance that Putin ever stops, and you probably heard this, Matt, he's got to gain something. Like, you don't quit when you're perceived to be winning. I know I've asked you this before, but has it shifted whatever? I mean, what is going to make him sit back in his chair and go, this is the best I'm going to get? What is his end goal here? Has that shifted at all, do you think, or not?
Oh, it definitely has. The end goal at the beginning of the war in 2014 and then with the invasion in 2022
mm-hmm.
was really to topple the Ukrainian government, to make it illegitimate, to take over political control of the country, and probably to take over physical control, at least of the eastern half, including Kyiv. When that failed, right, when the attack on Kyiv failed in 2022, things shifted and Putin changed his rhetoric. And now he's talking about holding these regions in the east that he claims are properly understood to be Russian and not Ukrainian. And so that's really what he's going for now. And he needs to achieve a way to declare victory. That is not necessarily achieve victory, but achieve a way to declare it for his own political purposes. And that shifts over time. But it certainly does not involve the Ukrainians getting much of what they want.
Do you think, Matt, or the guest is Dr. Matt Schmidt from the University of New Haven, did he underestimate the Ukraine resolve here and or the military and or Western support? Could Putin, as smart as he is, could he have made a major mistake here or not?
He absolutely did. He's not actually considered that smart by people on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
He's quite resilient, but he's not considered a military genius or particularly bright in that way.
Yeah.
Just to put that out there, people often think that about him. But no, for sure, he made a major strategic blunder. His military did. They completely underestimated Ukrainian capacity and resolve and Western support at the beginning.
That's interesting, because is that underestimation, Matt, coming from a lack of intelligence, or might he have been told that and just didn't want to believe it? You know, is the KGB that off their game, or maybe they don't exist to the same height they used to, or why did he, is there a chance that he was told, listen, this is going to be tough, if not impossible, and he didn't care?
Racism. It's the same reason that imperial powers always underestimate their colonial foes, right? Mm. It's the same reason we underestimated the difficulty of fighting in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And these kinds of things. And they simply, Putin uses the word, right? The word he uses to describe Eastern Ukraine is little Russia, as in like little kid, right? As in child, as in not fully adult, not fully something that we should fear or respect their capacity. And that is the larger worldview that the Russian leadership and largely the Russian population has of Ukraine right now.
I am amazed, Matt, in reading the daily or weekly summaries of what's going on, an attack after attack after attack, at the large amount of armaments that are used on both sides here. Now there was word that maybe the U.S. reserves are running a little bit low, and we're talking about kind of this third-party funneling of more arms here. That surprised you? Because I'm just seeing the sheer numbers in these drone attacks. 100 drones, 200 drones, 250. I mean, does this stuff ever run out or not?
Oh, well, so that's the big question right now. First, on the Ukrainian side, they're the largest producer of drones in the world.
Wow.
In the middle of an existential war. They're going to produce 4 to 4.5 million drones this year under fire from the Russians, just to explain how much warfare has changed right now. And, you know, and the Russians are expending weapon systems and ammunition at such a high rate that they need to bring this war to a ceasefire in the next 6 months, or they're in real trouble because their factories aren't able to replenish things, which is what they're trying to do. They're trying to force an offensive in the next, you know, 4 months, say, in order to put Ukraine up against the wall as much as possible and then negotiate. But if they don't do that in the next 4, 5, 6 months, they're in real trouble.
Couple of things more, Matt. What do you draw from this idea? I guess there's a bipartisan bill in Congress. Mr. Blumenthal, Dick Blumenthal, spoke about it at length on one of the Sunday shows, that would give the president, Mr. Trump, or I guess any future president as well, but in this situation, the ability to dial up and dial back and adjust these, what they say would be crippling sanctions on Russia. You buy that or not?
Yeah, so they're not sanctions on Russia. Blumenthal's bill is great because it's not targeting Russia. It's putting sanctions on third parties who are dealing with Russia and trading with Russia. So it's fundamentally sanctions on China and sanctions on India. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is that if you put sanctions on China and India, then you put the American consumer, right, in the middle of this thing. Yeah. And so it's unclear whether or not there's the kind of resolve that you need in any White House to go through with this. And that's why the Russians are laughing at this, saying, yeah, whatever, you know, you're not actually going to do this.
And finally, I did read a fascinating story, Matt, a couple of months ago. I think it was in the BBC, where they talked about the fact that a great deal of the funding for this war, ironically, comes from maybe some American allies and other people who, you know, you'd think are on our side. But the trade continues, doesn't it, in Russian gas, in Russian oil, and in rare earths. And does this buy into, Matt, that old joke that I read that, you know, Russia, big country, but in a sense, it's a big gas station with nukes. I mean, are some of our allies, as the BBC alleged, still funding this thing indirectly?
Oh, absolutely. That's going on. You know, India is probably the biggest culprit in terms of our allies who are doing this. The problem that Russia faces is whatever short-term success that they can get out of this war and out of, you know, violating sanctions and finding, you know, third parties to sell to that they didn't before is, excuse me again, they've killed off their biggest market. Their oil and gas market in Europe was the biggest revenue source for the country for decades. And that ain't coming back. And so Putin can win in the short term and really hurt the long term economic and political position of Russia. And, you know, that's what people like me are saying over and over again. But at this point, Putin doesn't care because it's all short-term thinking for him.
Dr. Matthew Schmidt, University of New Haven Associate Professor, Homeland and National Security and International Affairs. Matt, always good to chat with you. Take care. Have a happy weekend. We appreciate it.
Thanks, all.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. So there you go. Yes, a lot of problems we do have. And you remember about a week or so ago, I was musing about the latest CNBC rankings of how when it comes to where the rubber meets the road on key things for business, Connecticut sucks. Now, we have a nice quality of life. We did well in quality of workforce. But in taxes, regulations, and business-friendly items, we suck. And we embrace it, too. Well, we found something else that we suck in. Connecticut ranks, I'm sorry, but listen, I'm just telling you how it is. Connecticut ranks 37th among states. Forget this. How easy the tax code makes fulfilling paperwork obligations for non-resident workers. That's according to the folks at the National Taxpayers Union. And we've had them on before, and we have them on again right now. And joining us, the National Taxpayers Union, Interstate Commerce Initiative Director and Senior Policy Analyst, Andrew Wilford, is with us. Hey, Andrew, it's Paul here in Connecticut, where all the business stuff sucks. How are you?
I'm great, Paul. Thanks so much for having me on.
I'm sorry,
you
Andrew.
Really, but really I just put it. Much better than I did.
I just look at the numbers, man. I'm not too smart here, but I'm just a numbers guy here in the great state of Connecticut, or as I like to put it, the People's Republic of Connecticut, but I'm kidding here. All right, so what this ranking measures as far as out-of-state workers, explain why we do so lousy in this area as well.
Yeah, so there's really two reasons. Well, you know, the first one is something that I think a lot of people don't even know is a thing, mm-hmm. And it's that when you travel to Connecticut, if you spend a single day working in Connecticut, you are obligated, you know, if you're non-resident, you travel to Connecticut, you are obligated to file a tax return for the income you earn on that single day. Now, I mean, for the vast, vast majority of people, if you're spending a single day earning income in a state, you probably are going to be paying more to TurboTax to add another state to your, you know, your tax return come tax time, then you're actually paying in tax for that one day.
So, Andrew, so immediately the question pops in my head, and I think some of my listeners might be wondering about this too. So I'm driving somewhere. Let's say I'm driving from Boston and I'm going to Massachusetts or Maine, whatever, and I'm working. But the weather's lousy, or I don't feel well, or I plan to stop over. So we stop at a hotel or a motel here in Fairfield County or in Milford or in Hartford. And I get to my room and I order some bad food, whatever. And I say, let me check my emails and let me return some emails. Oh, I can do that Zoom meeting from my room. Did I just work in the state of Connecticut?
Yeah, you're not going to want to tell the Department of Revenue about that. But yeah, you did.
Really? All right.
And, you know, You can take some pride in the fact that some states around you are even worse. New York says that if you take a phone call while you're driving through New York, you just worked in New York.
Come on. Come on.
So, you know, that's one reason.
Yeah.
And you know, that's a pretty big reason.
Yeah.
But the other reason is that, and you know, again, I gotta give Connecticut some credit here for not being New York and explain that New York is the reason why this happens.
Yeah.
But Connecticut says that if you're a Connecticut resident and you switch to working remotely for the same Connecticut based business to working remotely in New York, you still owe Connecticut income tax. And the reason they do this is because New York does the same thing back. So I gotta, you know, I understand why it happens.
Yeah.
But at the same time, all this is doing, you know, this is a battle between New York legislators and Connecticut legislators. And at the end of the day, what's happening is that people in the middle are the regular taxpayers who are caught, you know, between in this, you know, petty battle between state legislatures. And they're the ones who are paying taxes to two different states, often double tax. And, you know, they're really getting the short end of the stick here. So while I understand that it's a response to New York which started doing the bad thing. I don't give any credit to Connecticut for doing the bad thing back.
So is there a chance of double taxation here? If somebody works remotely from Connecticut for a New York company, per se, and that's New York income, do they have to pay taxes in both states?
Yeah, I mean, that's often the case, because if a state that you're not living in, you're not working in, says that you owe income tax to that state, well, the state you are living in and you are working in, they're going to say you owe income tax too. So, you know, it's obvious which of the two is being the unreasonable one, but it doesn't really help you if you're the taxpayer, because you have that obligation to both states.
Interesting, interesting. And now, what states do it right?
Well, you know, states, Indiana, I think, is the one. Well, I should say states that have no income tax, this isn't a problem, because, you know, it's, you can't have income tax liability in another, in a state if there's no income tax there.
Sure.
But states that do, Indiana has adopted 30-day thresholds where they say you if you come and you work here for less than 30 days, we're not going to, you know, you don't owe anything. You just pay tax to your home state like normal. They've adopted what are called reciprocity agreements, where they just agree with neighboring states that, hey, we're all just going to tax people who live here. We're not going to worry about who's coming across state lines. If your residents come and work here, we're not going to tax them. If our residents come and work there, you're not going to tax them. It just simplifies everything. So, you know, states that have done that have really they've really set the standard for, you know, being a lot more friendly and just sort of offering an environment to both, you know, remote workers and businesses, and saying, hey, we're not going to harass you over the silly stuff. If you're working here, if you're doing business here, you have a substantial presence, you know, we expect you to pay tax. But if you're traveling, you know, you have a minimal presence here, we're not going to harass you over that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that doesn't do much to the budget, because, like I said, we're talking about really pretty petty amounts of revenue. But at the same time, it tells businesses that, you know, they're dealing with people who are reasonable, who are trying to work with them. And, you know, unfortunately, that's not the case right now with Connecticut.
Interesting. Andrew Wilford, National Taxpayers Union. Andrew, thank you. Good to chat with you. I'm sure we'll chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.